multinational corporations dancing on the ruins. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly cable program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Julia Stoops, author of the novel Parts Per Million from Forest Avenue Press. Julia is a recipient of Oregon Arts Commission fellowships for visual arts and literature, and she was a resident at the UCross Foundation in 2016. She holds dual degrees in visual art and photography and received an MFA in painting from Portland State University. Julia has experience in alternative radio news journalism at Portland's KABU Community Radio, you might know it, as well as a background in teaching media studies, visual art, and the history of ideas. She's a native of New Zealand and now makes her home here in Portland, where she was a member of the Pinewood Table Writing Group. Portland's also the setting of Parts Per Million, Julia's debut novel, and a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. In the words of writer and political activist Robert Newman, Parts Per Million effortlessly weaves the personal with the political in this relentless page-turner. Part psychological thriller, part hard-boiled noir, her characters are fresh, real, and alive, with a lightness of touch and an uncanny ear for great dialogue. Julia Stoops tells the story of four activists in a time of war, their moral and emotional conflicts, their betrayals, and their small acts of heroism. Parts Per Million reads like the bastard offspring of Graham Greene and Naomi Klein. Julia Stoops, welcome.
Thanks very much, Ken. It's really fantastic to be here.
Now, before we get to the novel, let's go into a little background. You started in visual arts rather than writing, and you have an incredible portfolio that listeners can browse on your website, juliastoops.net. And some of those pieces go back over 20 years. Were you also writing at that time or doing visual art exclusively?
Yeah, I was always a visual artist, and that's my first love. It was my, you know, I went to college very young as a visual artist, and I've had an exhibition career for quite a long time now. I would say probably 30 years at this point. My website doesn't go back that far because at some point you've got to curate the old stuff out.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was a huge surprise to me. It was 2001 when I suddenly got a writing bug, because I never considered myself to be a writer. I didn't have any ambition to be a writer. I didn't have any sense that I was a writer. I've always been able to write things like proposals and stuff like that. You know, I've always had like a fairly good command of sort of, you know, just written language and so on. But I never considered myself to be a fiction writer. I didn't have any desire to be a fiction writer. I didn't really have a story to tell in that kind of narrative way. And then suddenly I got a sort of compulsion to write down a story that was kind of stuck in my head. And I didn't really know what to do with this for a while. And then one day I started typing it out. I literally started just typing out the story that was in my head. And I found that the pieces that I typed out were no longer stuck in my head going round and round and round. So I figured, well, maybe I'm supposed to just get this out, this whatever this thing is. And this was in 2001. So it was actually before the novel is set. The novel set in 2002, 2003, but the story arc I laid down in 2001. In this strange, feverish sort of compulsion to sort of vomit up this story that was in my head, and I just really didn't know what to do with it.
And that was Julia, I'm sorry, I just want to set the time period. So that was a reaction to 9/11 and kind of everything that happened after that.
Yeah, kind of that post 9/11, just very strange time, you know, reaction to just the sort of the shutting down of critical thinking that was happening. And if you think just, you know, very few years before that, in 1999, there was really quite an uprising among activists, you know, who were becoming very aware of what was happening in the Global South. And there was a real sense of activism gaining some traction. You know, if you think about the WTO protests and shutting down the WTO, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then all that stuff became very difficult to do, and activists really sort of hunkered down after 9/11 because dissent became really very suspect. And so I was reacting to that. I was very troubled by that because I felt like it was the beginning stages of a sort of fascistic mindset and a fascistic state. And this was during the height of the Bush administration. So I wrote the story in response to that. And then I didn't do anything with it for about a year because I didn't even tell anybody that I'd done this because I literally had no mental model into which to place this thing that I'd done. It was like I just had this little secret garden that I dug, and I didn't tell anybody because, you know, no one thought I was a gardener. and so, but then after a while, you know, I literally just sort of put it in a drawer kind of thing. Well, you know, it was on my hard drive. And after a while, about a year, I thought, well, maybe I did that for a reason. Maybe I should do something with this. And so I knew that it was not crafted well, just because I knew I didn't have fiction writing craft skills. And so I thought, well, maybe I need to kind of clean this up and see if I can do something with it. So I joined a writing critique group, and that was in 2002.
And that was Pinewood Table.
That was the Pinewood Table, yes, led by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose. And that writing critique group is still going. It's awesome. Everything I learned about the craft of fiction writing, I learned at that table, and that, you know, we meets weekly and, you know, like looks at all kinds of things like language and point of view and structure and all kinds of good stuff. And so I learned a lot. It was a really, really fantastic learning experience. So during those years, I didn't do that much visual art when I was really, you know, editing the novel. It was like many, many years of revisions and edits and so on. And then the effort to get it published also is like another story. But then once all that was done, I've returned to visual art, and I do really feel like visual art is my first love. And so writing the novel was a little bit like having an affair, you know. it was crazy and wild and different and exciting. But then I returned back to my first love, visual art.
I was wondering, you had kind of the story in your head, and you mentioned the word compulsion in terms of having to get it out. How did it come out as writing rather than a visual art, which was the art form you were most familiar with?
I sat down and I typed. I didn't really write longhand very much. It was more kind of typing, and it was a sense of like this, like a movie playing in my imagination, and I just described what I saw. Do you know what I mean? So I just typed out, you know, like sort of as it was happening. I should say at the same time, I was exploring a character in my visual art, and it was this character who is standing in a desert, and he's wearing a suit, and he looks like he's waiting for something to happen, and he's just sort of standing there as if he is perhaps lost or stunned, or maybe just like on the edge of you know, understanding that something's about to happen. And this everyman character kept appearing in my visual art at the time, and he did get woven into one of the main characters of my novel.
And that's John Nelson.
So he was explored in a sort of abstract, symbolic way visually. But when I was doing those paintings, I wasn't really thinking, you know, this is Nelson. It was like Nelson sort of grew out of that symbol, and Nelson became this person who was very clearly defined in terms of having a history and a personality and, you know, intentions and motivations and things like that.
No, I did.
So there was some overlap.
Yeah, I did look on the website and saw those art pieces of the character that became Nelson. And you described him on the website, and I'm quoting here, an everyman figure and the principal character in my novel who is struggling and disillusioned and unsure of which path to walk upon. He stands in chaotic spaces and sometimes interacts or fails to interact with small blue objects and lights that float around him. There's frustration and even despair with hints of hope, perhaps a reflection of living through the early 21st century's political changes. Now, oddly enough, I felt that was a big theme of the book. So,
That's exactly the theme of the book. And Nelson is sort of right there experiencing that kind of almost in real time. He's this person who, he still believes on some level that the positive democratic structures that were put in place by earlier generations still work as they were meant to, and basic institutions designed to protect ordinary people hadn't been gutted, and so on. That this idea that sort of what's right and fair will ultimately prevail because society is rational and has checks and balances and so on. So he still believes that, in 2002. And there's something towards the beginning of the book where, the characters hear President Bush declare what was called the doctrine of preemptive strike, just this idea that the United States is allowed to basically go to war against a country, not because the country has declared war or done an act of aggression or anything, but just in case they might, which is what they did, what we did with Iraq, went to war with Iraq, just in case they might go to war with us.
And of course, there was a bunch of what was proved to be false reports of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Exactly. Yeah, it was all just made up baloney. So, so there's this piece near the beginning of the book where they hear this over the radio, and Nelson's just like baffled. He's just like, he's like, no way, that's against international law. the UN wouldn't let him, right? And so this is sort of like the part of I think the hinge of the early 21st century was like this crumpling of certain edifices that seemed like they were going to last for a long time, and so he's living through that, and he's, I tried really hard in the novel to not be
dogmatic, kind of, or
yeah, like not be preachy, not be dogmatic, not have any character say use monologues to express complex political ideas, because people don't really talk like that. I really wanted the dialogue to be very realistic. So there's no long paragraphs that describe, what's going on in any sort of like editorial way or anything, but it's just the background of what's happening. It just seeps into their lives. There's like snippets of things on TV and snippets of things that people say, and, they'll glance at a newspaper headline here and there and so on. And so it's all part of that kind of background noise of what the characters are dealing with it, and how hard that is to deal with, because it's hard to understand it at the time that it's happening. It just doesn't seem quite believable,
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Julia Stoops, author of the novel Parts Per Million from Forest Avenue Press. Now, I want to get to some of the other characters, too. But first, when you first started at the Pinewood table with Joanne and Stephen, what did the story look like? Was it much different from the final version, the book that I read?
I would say it was very different, yes. It was very different. One big difference is formally the draft that I brought to the Pinewood table was... it was all written in like third person omniscient point of view. So like, me, the narrator, saying, he did this, she did that.
Right.
The kind of thing. And that was just because that was the only way I knew how to write. I had never studied fiction. I'd never studied creative writing. I'd never even studied like literature. I was always into, when I did my BA, I was more interested in philosophy and linguistics and so on. So I knew I was very green, and so I brought this, rather clunky green, green as in undeveloped, not green as in environmental. It was green also, novel to the table. And so one of the big changes that happened was I explored writing from specific points of view in voice. And that was something that they really encourage people to explore. So writing from the point of view and in the voice of different characters, and also writing in scenes. So the idea of writing, you know, like each chapter is a scene, it's a short scene, and there isn't that much kind of narrative description going on. There's a little bit from one of the characters, Fetzer, who his point of view is from the past. So he's first person, but he writes from the past. Like he narrates his stuff as, you know, because it happened in the past. And so he, you know, he sometimes fills in with like little bits of commenting about like, we thought it was this, but we realized it was that, or, you know, some kind of description. But the other two, Nelson and Jen, are both in the present. And so we get them kind of in real time. And so, you know, each chapter is a scene. Jen particularly is very, she's first person present. So and that sort of fits her personality because she's impulsive and she's quick and she's kind of irritable and so on. And so we just get her almost sort of like, not quite stream of consciousness exactly, but, you know, we get her thinking her thoughts just as she's thinking them, and so on. And Nelson is also first person. He's also in the present, but he's third person.
He's third person present, yes.
Third person present, yeah, because he, of all the characters, he's the least grounded because he starts out the novel in the state of crisis. And so I felt like putting him in third person instead of first person was a way of adding a little bit of distance to his character, a little bit of a disconnect, even though it's a very standard way to write. Like, it's not an unusual way to write or anything. It just makes him a little bit less, you know, you're not quite as sort of centered in the character when you're in his scenes as you are in with the other two main characters.
Yes, it gives a little distance.
Yeah.
Now I read that, Julie, originally, well, those, of course, are the three major characters in the book. There were two others I read that you also had narrating. So there were chapters from their points of views. There's Deirdre, who plays a big part in the book, and Frankie, a little bit of a lesser character in terms of the narrative. So you also had chapters from their points of view in the first few drafts?
I did, yeah. When I first started exploring writing in voice and scene, I had five point of view characters, five voices. And indeed, Deirdre and Frankie both had points of view. And Frankie was more, he had bigger visibility in the novel than he does now. His visibility gradually decreased in the novel. And part of it was because I ended up writing something that was way too long and I just had to cut stuff out. And so Frankie, I ended up dropping his point of view pretty early on because he turned out to be very difficult for me to write. It was hard for me to inhabit Frankie.
Oh, why was that? Just he was so different from your own personality or people that you've known?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. He's kind of like a little bit of comic relief in a way, because he's kind of like this goofy guy, and
kind of like a sidekick in.
He's kind of like a
movie.
Sidekick. Uh-huh. Yeah, and yeah, it just didn't seem necessary to have his point of view in the story. So.
So that fourth character, Deirdre, that was a little tougher to remove her from the narrative.
When I let go of her voice, I mourned letting go of Deirdre because she's a very important character in the novel, and her voice was it was different from the others, not just because she's from a different country, she's from Ireland and so on, but also she's in a very different place in her life. She's essentially adrift, and she sees the world through aesthetic eyes, you know, and so she had this kind of drifty, meandering, quite lyrical, poetic voice. And it was also full of tragedy because she has tragedy in her past, and that's becomes, without giving too much away, her undoing, or the lack of resolution of that becomes her undoing. And so she was a pretty fascinating character to write. And I really enjoyed her point of view. And also, she doesn't take for granted, because she's new in the household, she doesn't take for granted the things the others take for granted. So she was a really good vehicle for explaining, you know, just things like the habits of the others and what they look like and what it's like to live in that household and what the household looks like, and, you know, and so on. And so, because they all take it for granted, they've lived there for years, they've lived with each other for years, and they're not about to like start, you know, explaining in detail, because you're in their heads, you know, they're not really narrating a story to the reader, they're thinking inside their heads. So taking her point of view out was a real challenge, because I had to then somehow get a lot of her descriptive stuff where she's describing their world, you know, just the physicality of their world, I had to get it on the page in other ways without making my characters suddenly start explaining to the narrator, you know, like what things look like and what it's like to wake up in this household, and, you know, that there's like fabric tacked up on the windows because they can't afford curtains and so on. So, but I took out her point of view because it was upstaging everybody else, and that became an issue. You know, I felt like her story was one I could write a novel about, but I didn't want to. I'd started out writing a novel about these activists. I didn't want it to be a novel about a woman who had experienced a certain kind of tragedy, and that had nothing to do with, you know, activism or the state of the world or anything. And I could see the novel becoming that, and I just didn't want to write that novel. It wasn't what I had started out doing, and it wasn't really what I was committed to. So in order to kind of save the novel, I removed her point of view, and that was like a really, really hard choice, a very hard choice.
Now, I saved this question for last, and I have to ask, the novel's a snapshot of that particular time in recent American history. So as we mentioned, just after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, people remember back that far the demonization of Muslims, people from the Middle East, the Iraq invasion, the weapons of mass destruction mythology, the 2002 midterm elections. So November of that year, when Republicans mm-hmm. won the Senate, they already had the House. They extended their majority. You had George W. Bush in the White House. And you even mention Donald Trump in the book as a jokey aside by one of the characters.
Yeah.
And as bad as all that was, you know, we lived through it. It seems almost tame compared with what we're going through now with the corruption and incompetence of that Donald Trump in the White House, which has led to a current state of fear, the financial anxiety we first talked about when we sat down here, our unpreparedness for the coronavirus pandemic. Now, you started the book in 2002. What did you feel as you were making revisions? And I think up until the book was published, so maybe was that after the 2016 election?
The book was published. The book was acquired before the election. It was acquired in the summer of 2016, but then it was published in 2018. Just because it was a very long process towards, you know, publication in the world of fiction. I totally agree. I feel like, and this is something that struck me when you know, if you remember November 9th, 2016, the day after the election, a lot of people who didn't expect Trump to get in were absolutely devastated.
Devastated,
you know,
it's
like
the right word.
It was shocking. It was like the worst thing that could have happened and unbelievable and so on.
And we weren't wrong.
and we weren't wrong, exactly. And so when Laura at Forest Avenue acquired the manuscript, she acquired it because she loved the characters. She wanted a realistic novel set in the recent past. She thought the activism thing was interesting because there were, you know, there had been quite a bit of activism happening in the prior year or two, you know, around Black Lives Matter and so on. And so she, to her, it was like almost like a, not a historical novel exactly, but, you know, she just felt like it was a novel with like it's a very character driven novel, even though it's historically, you know, set in a very specific time. It's very character driven, and that's why she acquired it. And so we sort of really had no idea that it would suddenly become relevant in that way. You know, we, like, I think a lot of people thought that the Bush administration and that sort of giddy slide into fascism and you know, warmongering and just total information awareness and, you know, Operation Tips and the Homeland Security, you know, just all that
Patriot Act.
Establishment of the Patriot Act, the surveillance state and everything was some sort of aberration that would sort of eventually sort of boil off. And then suddenly, no, we're back in that crazy time. And so suddenly the novel became really relevant on, you know, not just like an interesting novel about some interesting people, but really relevant to. And so that's something that, you know, I think a lot of us are feeling a very deep sense of loss and have been for a few years now, culturally, socially, personally. And that loss is just ratcheted up now with the coronavirus, you know, causing people to lose their livelihoods and their ability to even just like be with each other and so on. And so we're undergoing some really challenging societal transformations, and we're not through it, you know, we're in the middle of it. And the characters in the novel, they go through loss and they go through transformation, particularly Nelson. So at the time, you know, when I was writing it, I felt like it was a metaphor for something larger. And another thing that I think is really relevant in the novel that's relevant today is, on the left, I think we're often fighting among ourselves. Right at the time when we need to come together and create a cohesive movement in resistance to the, you know, in capital letters, bad things that are happening. And so like the characters in Parts Per Million, they sort of start to split apart under pressure, but they get through it. And I really hope on a larger scale, so will we all. Even though the novel has sad things in it and so on, it does end on a hopeful note. And people who've read the novel tell me that it's inspiring for them. So I hope that it can be like a, you know, a small beacon of hope around the possibility of transformation, the possibility, you know, the fact that the potential is always there. And I think Nelson is a metaphor for potential in that regard.
Well, Julia, that's a good way to end on that note of hope and optimism, and I feel the same way. Again, thanks so much for joining us today under these very odd conditions, you know, where we're doing this at Skype. I'm at home, you're at home. Please stay healthy and safe.
Thanks, Ken.
We've been talking with Julia Stoops, author of the novel Parts Per Million from Forest Avenue Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Julia for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening.